Pseudopod, episode 105, August 29th, 2008. This week's story, Pattern Masters, by Jeff Carlson. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm Alistair, your host, and this week's story comes to us from Jeff Carlson, author of the excellent Plague Year, Plague War, and numerous pieces of short fiction. Your narrator this week is David Moore, whose role-playing podcasts are essential listening for any GMs out there. So, grab your coloured pens and your maps, and be ready to note any new movements, because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
Pattern Masters, by Jeff Carlson. Sauber wasn't crazy. He'd planned on never hitting the same place twice. He even kept a checklist near the toilet in case it needed to be destroyed in a hurry. But 209 days crawled past before he'd bagged every store in Berkeley and Oakland, so it seemed impossible that anyone would remember him at Greenwald's, his favorite, his first. Sauber was at the register before the girl stopped him. "Those are mine," she said, reaching out. He held the packet against his chest. "What?" "Look at the label." Of course, he'd already studied it carefully. 36 exposures, regular 35mm film. Jennifer Crisp. The address, written in delicate cursive, was just two blocks from here. Adrenaline spilled from his veins into his gut. The girl was half his age, peasant-faced, her nose like a ski jump. Yet her breasts were perfect, small and neat, her white bra outlined against her thin white blouse. At 5'9 or 10, she had at least an inch on him, and maybe 10 pounds. Sauber made a show of examining the packet with a smile. "Right. Geez, these all look the same." He'd practiced the words so many times that he'd managed to sound bored. It still wasn't convincing. The green envelopes were exactly the same, except for the personal information each customer jotted down. The girl's fingers closed on the packet. Sauber knew he should let go. Let go and stop grinning like a chimpanzee. But her skin was smooth, wonderful. She wore more rings than he could count in a glance. She smiled back at him and said, "You sure would have been surprised when you got home." Sauber's eyes lifted toward the security cameras. What were the odds that he'd pull the packet from the wide drawers just as its owner arrived? 1 in 1,000? Higher, given the vagaries of timing. Much higher. He wasn't crazy. He'd been set up. The photo department at Greenwald's was tiny. Crushed in back between two rows of overpriced groceries and the bright, gigantic counters of the pharmacy. He'd shopped here before, scouting the place, and knew that his quickest exit was through the rear. But were the stockroom doors unlocked? "Don't worry about it," the girl said, as the heavy-set photo clerk stepped out from behind the register. The man's eyes were lost under wiry, dark brows. Sauber turned to run. Her grip was unbelievably strong. The two of them fumbled the packet, and it careened off the back of Sauber's calf as he spun away. The sharp-cornered impact felt like a knife. He hit a rack of disposable cameras with his shoulder, kicked through the avalanche of small yellow boxes, fell, got up, slammed into a swinging door. In the dim, confusing maze of the stockroom, two men shouted at him. He reached daylight sooner than he'd hoped, scrambling under a giant truck and around a corner before he stopped to look and listen. Four blocks over, he thought he saw the girl again behind the wheel of a dented VW Bug. The sprawling Cal Berkeley campus was Sauber's second favorite place in the world. A sea of loud, young voices, firm bodies, their hairstyles and ridiculous piercings, lips, noses. Once he'd seen a forehead ring. Always made him smile. It was a safe, colorful environment where anonymity was the rule. Today it seemed like the kids weren't ignoring him. Black grease from beneath the truck coated his butt and both knees, and his thoughts felt very loud. He kept his head down and his feet moving, but avoided the shortcut behind the clock tower. The thought of that narrow alley made him edgy. Sauber had always planned on bluffing his way out of a confrontation. Causing a scene would only make him more memorable. All he'd had to do was apologize and then realize that he'd tried the new digital service, the one that Greenwald sent out for an extra day, And presto kazam, he was just another moron you might joke about with your husband over dinner. He'd panicked. His streak of bad luck wasn't letting up, and he'd gone stupid over a simple coincidence. If the police did know about him, they wouldn't bother with an elaborate sting operation and sexy decoys. They'd come to his apartment. Now they had his fingerprints. A description. Outside the science building, three girls and a hairy boy stood in a ring playing hacky sack while another girl circled them, crouching here and there with a pocket camera. Kick it up, she said. Her jeans were very tight. Sauber felt his anxiety lift for a moment, wishing he was that boy, imagining he had such friends. He couldn't stop now. A newspaper stood precisely on end against the door of his split level. Sauber stared. The Montclarian was a free publication that he'd given up trying to have stopped, yet it had never been left anywhere except in his spotty, muddy strip of grass. He hurried forward and opened all four locks. The small apartment wasn't anything great. Its only real window faced right into the street. But the entrance was fairly private, and he didn't have to share. And it had only taken two heavy tarps and a little soundproofing to transform the bedroom into a decent workshop. Sauber threw the newspaper into the trash and went to the fridge. A blink of red caught his eye. The answering machine. Two blinks. Sauber hesitated, then walked to the counter. He tried to remember the last time someone had called. A salesman. His ex didn't even have this number. Then the phone rang and Sauber yanked his hand back. He took a step toward the front door, but turned and strode to the bedroom, propelled entirely by instinct. Guarding that doorway, he stared back at the phone. His heart beat so hard that it seemed to squeeze his lungs down against his stomach. The machine still had Deb's tired voice. "Hi, nobody here. You know what to do." Silence poured out of the speaker into his home. He heard a faint scuffling like someone shifting from one foot to another. He didn't move. The caller hung up. When he ventured forward to hit the play button, the first two messages were the same expectant quiet. Someone listening. The workshop was an awful mess that he'd planned on cleaning this afternoon, but he was restless, nervy, and he still needed at least one more score. He grabbed a different jacket and a Niners cap, tucking his hair up to further change his appearance, remembering clean pants at the last minute. He had that bad sensation of suffocating again as he stood outside his front door, triple-checking the locks. But nothing happened. No one approached. "Nobody is watching you," he thought. The congestion downtown was comforting. Beggars, skate punks, businessmen. He became invisible. He caught glimpses of different lives through the windows and sliding glass doors of the university dorms, a hideous red leather couch, the smell of grilled cheese. A bare-shouldered woman singing under the turbine roar of a blow dryer was his favorite. At the sorority house, zero progress had been made on the steel patio fence that they'd been building since July. Long's drugs seemed deserted, and his feet clicked loudly against the gleaming tile floor. He fingered through the D's and E's until a row of flower heads drawn across the top of a packet caught his eye. Amy Ellison. An off-campus address. Roughly 1 in 30 people got impatient with alphabetical groupings and marked their packets outside the space provided to make theirs more noticeable. Stars, looping circles, jagged black scribbles. He found these choices very revealing. Sauber splurged on some candy bars and paid cash. If he got lucky, this one might be the end of it. In the parking lot, the girl from Greenwald stood waiting against her dented VW, arms folded, a smile tucked into the corner of her mouth. Sauber was so surprised that he walked straight over, awash in a perverse sense of relief. "Someone has been watching me." The only question that occurred to him was so intriguing that he almost shouted, "What are you doing?" "What are you?" she countered. "All these pictures." Her eyes were blue-green, very sharp, and her eyebrows had that same razor quality, thin and perfect. One of her incisors was half gone, chipped off. A tomboy. How much did she know? "I'm Nina. the girl said. The name on that packet was Jennifer. It wasn't mine. I was just trying to start a conversation. Sauber hoped his smile looked right. So what's the secret? She asked. She had a habit of shaking her head to one side when she finished speaking that he liked. She was rude, confident, crazy. I'll show you, he said. He got her inside because she moved the same way that she talked, without hesitation. Not getting into her tiny car with him, not parking on the dark street, not at his front door. She finally wavered in the doorway to his bedroom, the toes of one shoe crackling on the heavy tarp laid over the carpet. He worried that it smelled funny. He worried that he couldn't see her face. He should have cleaned. Jesus, she said. He came up behind her. Who else knows about me? This is amazing. In most ways, the sculpture was a departure for him. Deb probably wouldn't have recognized it as his. The work was too busy, too bright, too anthrocentric. The base structure conformed to a human shape. His own, he imagined telling interviewers, because he hadn't wanted the piece to overwhelm with sheer bulk. It also had to fit through the door. Yet its every surface was flat, aside from a concave dish where the face should be. An oversized dish. None of the proportions were correct. The left bicep squashed into a pyramid, one hip no more than a dangling cube. The fingers of the right hand represented by flat 10-inch strips. The man's shape appeared to run or jump or perhaps just swoon. Perhaps all three. It depended on where you stood and what was visible of its skin. The skin, of course, was a mosaic of pictures. Nina stepped forward in a rush and paced through snippings, cans, power tools. The man shape danced with her. She said, "This is absolutely amazing. You'll be famous." Deb had always promised the same. Poor Deb. Small and large, cropped or whole, color, black and white. At first, the hundreds of images shotgunned the mind. Then the eye found a place to rest, and then patterns emerged. Nina paused as a particular grouping caught her. The right shoulder. Sauber nodded to himself. The skin there consisted of healthy young men, some shirtless, one nude, many playing to the camera. Along the arm were tuxedos and brides, homes, children. Further down the ribcage, the young men merged abruptly with a series of infirm seniors, bald, baggy, and still monkeying for the camera, gumming pizza, fencing with canes. The skin was full of such contrasts. Ghettos and pristine deserts, parties and intensive care units. It was illuminating and magical and at the same time utterly horrific. It drew his eyes away from her. He'd lived with this tapestry of stolen lives for 8 months now, longer than any other work, and still it had the ability to make him forget himself. Sauber moved closer just as Nina brushed one fingertip over the mosaic. She pulled back, eyes wide. Sorry. He slapped his jaw. Indestructible. The base structure was concrete mixed with epoxy, the sort of thing to use as a shield against a nuclear blast, and he'd triple laminated the skin and planned to hit it twice more when he'd finished. Sauber had yet to skin the right calf or the great empty dish of a face, although he'd contemplated leaving that concave blank, hungry, groping. Or maybe that was too obvious. He'd already thrown in several conspicuous jokes. A life-sized ear precisely where it should be. Drunkards mooning the camera on the rump. Such literalism gave idiots something to understand, and in Sauber's experience it was crucial to market to numb-ass television zombies who wouldn't recognize their own existence without having their hands held. There were more of them than anyone else, after all. Therefore, they had most of the money, and their choices skewed everything. He wouldn't be using his own bedroom as a studio and surviving on credit cards if he'd done a better job of commercializing himself when he still had grants and a wife and a free warehouse space provided by the university. It's almost filled in, Nina said, caressing the back of the right calf. Will you use a picture of me? Someone would surely object to his placing a group of young women way down on the leg when the young men graced the shoulder, no matter that the space in between was filled perfectly with themes of age, professions, shots of guys shopping, and girls watching sports. This was Berserkly, after all, so packed with liberal freaks that during the Vietnam War, city leaders had actually proposed seceding from the United States of America. Someone would cry sexism, and Sauber dreamed of protests, media frenzies. He wasn't stupid. He'd learned that talent wasn't enough to sell, and controversy was publicity. He might even get national coverage after people started recognizing themselves inside the skin and filing lawsuits. "Please?" Nina said. "I'm better than anything in here." She lifted a Greenwalt's photo packet from her purse. 36 exposures, regular 35mm film. Jennifer Crisp. She'd stolen it herself. Sauber reached for the packet automatically, and Nina flashed her chipped tooth at him and laughed. They spread other lives across the kitchen counter, their fingers bumping together again and again, warm, eager. "That one's ridiculous," she said. "Throw it out." "You won't find a camera owner in the world who doesn't line up their friends and tell them to smile." "In a parking lot. Jesus." "But don't you see what's happening? The blonde's always in the middle and the fat one's on the end again. There's a whole series here." "Boring. Throw it out." "Ooh, look at all that sushi. The colors are..." "Come on, these Barbies don't have any imagination. They're just posing again. We got a bad batch." "Jesus, this lady needs help." "Are you kidding? I love this shot. It's of a wall. The camera must have gone off by accident." "There isn't space for it anyway." Sauber didn't object when Nina swept both sets of pictures into the garbage in great messy handfuls. He liked the way that she pinballed through her decisions. Typically, he'd brood over shots for days, even those he knew he wouldn't use, gleaning clues and patterns, groping his way into different realities. She clapped her hands together. "It must have taken forever to get all the pictures you needed." He shrugged, nodded. "I can show you whole libraries of stuff. Edgy, weird. We'll download whatever you want." "Download." She flashed that tooth again. Parking in her neighborhood was impossible. Nina beat her hand on the steering wheel impatiently, and Sauber hid a smile as they glided up the street and down again. Even in low gear, they moved faster than he could walk, allowing time only for fleeting impressions. It made him drunk. The Berkeley Hills were thickly populated, and the steep lots demanded unusual architecture. Houses with rooms lined up like train cars. Tiny yards on top of jutting roofs. Her place reeked of candle wax and incense, a tiny attic studio at the same level as the uphill street. Her kitchenette looked directly out on the tires of parked cars. Sauber loved it. He imagined eating breakfast at the window, watching shoes match up with vehicles as each morning commute began. City maps covered the short walls. The same map. Berkeley. He stepped around her rumpled bed for a closer look as she booted up a shiny new tangerine iMac in the corner. Tangled, angled lines had been sketched in a rainbow of colors across the black and white grids. "What's all this?" he asked. "The big one by the window is you." Nina Chavez had worked in credit fraud protection for less than a week before she grew obsessed. "Look," she said, pogo sticking an index finger across the city. "This guy is so anal, he'll skip the gas station right next to his house and drive all over town looking for a deal, even though he must spend twice what he saves just cruising around. Same with his groceries. Same with his dry cleaning. Almost never the same place twice." "Wow. Neat. Okay." They stared at the hectic patterns, and finally Sauber had to touch the map, feel the man's daze. Nina made a low sound in her throat, cat-like. Pleased. He turned and saw that her lower lip hung open, one slight, inviting fraction. Her eyes shifted towards his. Sauber looked away, but he thought maybe her gaze had flicked down to his mouth, too. He said, "What about this guy? He's just two big blots." "Electronics freak," her tone was boasting. "Always in the same couple shops, probably uses cash for everyday stuff. I'm sure he doesn't have any other cards. We barely approved him, and he's already at the edge. Minimum payments, always late. And me? She held his eyes, not smiling. She smelled terrific, like mango, he guessed. You're in a world of hurt, she said. I've written off almost $3,000 for you as merchant error or duplication in the last 2 months. Otherwise, you'd be maxed. Sauber had to sit down. There were a few big purchases he'd been waiting to pay for, but he'd thought... He didn't know what he'd thought. Deb was the math wizard. The idea of losing the very last of his possessions, his tools, the sculpture... No. He would become a thief before selling off what remained of his soul. The realization made him glad and sick. 2 or 3 robberies a month might be enough, and he knew dozens of stores intimately by now. Nina perched at the end of his bed beside him, intent on his face, but he was afraid to let her see his eyes. He was afraid of what her reaction might show. The bundled sheets were ripe with her scent, worn soft. He snuck his fingers deep into their folds. It's okay, she said. I can buy you more time. They stood shoulder to shoulder by the filthy window, examining his map. The trails he'd established weren't as curiously random as the penny pinchers, or as compulsive as those left by the electronics freak, or those of a woman Nina called the porn queen. But nevertheless, his pattern had intrigued her. It shrieked of desperation. Most people didn't use credit cards for $11 at the grocery store every other day, much less for $1.75 at Pete's Coffee. He had also drawn big cash advances at the end of the past 2 months. She assumed for rent, and he was constantly visiting hardware stores and craft shops. I had to know what you were doing, she said. Like the others, his map bore a tiny label at the bottom. Nina's handwriting was all sweeping jags and flares. Timothy J. Sauber, 38, 1113-C Bishop Drive, teacher, salary range, $19,750 to $23,000. Resentment crept through him as he understood that 10,000 computers and clerks had him pigeonholed. He'd never thought of himself as an instructor. It was just a job, a trade-off for studio space and a paycheck. Yet unseen armies considered this a vital definition of his being. Nina bumped his hip with her own. You think I'm nuts? I think your maps are great. Her maps were alien. I think we see things most people don't. She made that low sound again. That night and the next were ideal. Sauber wished someone could take a picture. Nina sat cross-legged, or happily lay belly down on the floor, shuffling her maps and colored pens and the printouts she'd stolen from work. He typed carefully at her computer. Sometimes she got up and stood behind him, sharing. Sometimes she laid a hand on his shoulder. The first sites and galleries she'd suggested seemed to lack authenticity. The scenes were too spectacular. Sleek girls painted by dance lights, a skier cutting through sprays of powder. But he was captivated by the promise of wealth. They chuckled together over morons posing with their pets, even fish tanks, and took turns reading aloud from personal webpages. Entire families were on display, labeled, often with short bios, and home addresses. That's crazy, Sauber said. He got excited over a poorly lit shot of an all-girl garage band fronted by a heavy teen in a wheelchair. Nina showed him how to download files, to use her printer. How much does this special paper cost? He asked, but she just shook her head. He caught her smiling at him 6 times. When she was in the bathroom, he smelled her bed again and felt the inside of her jacket. He never wanted to leave this quiet, oddly shaped apartment. But he was gentlemanly. Before 10 o'clock, he excused himself. Nina held out a key. I love watching you work, she said. But I'm at my job all day. You shouldn't have to wait. The damp fog and cold did nothing to quell his exploding mind. He would have said, I love you too, but it was too soon. Striding down the hill seemed effortless. An inspiration struck as he passed a jam-packed mailbox. He stuffed his pockets with everything that wasn't obviously a bill or advertising. The night was full of lighted windows like big TV screens, all tuned to family dramas. When he got home, his answering machine had two messages. Only silence again. He smiled to think that she didn't know what to say, either. He would have called back, but he wanted to keep the stolen mail a surprise until he could see her face. Nina seemed to purr, humming, growling, as she marked one of her maps to show the five addresses where he'd taken the mail. She could not sit still, bumping his side, throwing herself on her stomach, climbing back onto her knees. Salber's eyes rarely left the hem of her skirt. "Listen," she kept saying. "Listen to this," smoothing out personal letters and waving a postcard from Washington, D.C. Every phrase was wonderfully mundane. Finally, her energy carried her to the door. "How about some takeout Chinese?" she said. "I'm buying." And as they exited her building, she took his hand like a little girl, smiling, tugging up the hill to her car. She sped by an open space right across from the restaurant and pulled into a dark lot. She turned off the engine. Salbert took off his seatbelt, but paused with his fingers on the door when Nina touched his other hand. "Wait." She gazed at the busy street, random pedestrians, a pack of 13-year-olds smoking cigarettes under the brilliant lights of a corner store. She brought his hand to her sculpted leg. Together, they pushed her skirt up to mid-thigh. She parted her knees. Nina was loud, maybe deliberately. Twice, people on the sidewalk looked around as she ground down on him, her face turned to the window. Beneath her skirt, their skin overheated like putty, but his scalp felt chilled, his feet, his gut. He was so distracted that he didn't finish until she'd exhausted herself and slumped against him. His release was abrupt, an afterthought. She laughed against his neck and buried him in her hair. When she came home on the fifth night, he had a pot of canned ravioli waiting, but Nina ignored it, pawing through the stacks of paper by her printer. "What the hell is this?" she said. "Read the parts I marked. It's really incredible." "You spent all day in a chat room?" "Yeah, it's almost like watching people think." "Boring. All they do is complain." "It gave me an idea for a new piece." He dripped sauce on the stovetop, gesturing, and she started to say something, but he couldn't stop. "Imagine an American flag constructed out of special computer monitors. Ticker tapes, maybe. One stripe would be these anti-government loons, the next would..." "I can't cover for you forever." "What happens when you're out of money? You'll be on the street." "I'm almost done. I have enough pictures now." "Give me your key. Get out of here. Go finish it so you have something to sell. Otherwise, you're dead meat." But he couldn't stay away. Not because of the sex or her wicked smile. Because of her computer. Or, as Deb would insist, because he was subconsciously delaying the bleak, tiresome process of marketing himself to yups and straights. No artist enjoys explaining why beauty is beautiful, pimping for $12,000 in civic improvement awards, wasting days hoping to impress gallery managers with overcrowded schedules. He couldn't stay away because of all these things. Salber got spooked about the mailboxes he'd ransacked and hiked around the long way, approaching her house from up the hill. He wondered how many passerby were tempted to crouch down and peer through her kitchen window. He wondered how long Nina had been two-timing him with the chubby guy assembling radio equipment on her desk, the electronics freak from map number 6. Just a week before, Salber probably would have left, let it end, turtle deep into his work. But Nina had made him bold. He eased up the narrow, creaking stairs to her attic, taking the steps in random batches of 3 and 2, waiting for noise from other apartments, the rattle of plumbing, television laughter. Initially, he thought Nina had several men in her place, thought disgusting things. Then a shriek of static made him realize that, of course, the voices were radio broadcasts. She was loud. "Try that one. No, no, go back." Like a kid with a new toy. Salber considered ways to win her again. Then she said, "How about some takeout for dinner? I know the perfect place." He must have slept some that night because he dreamed he was back in her cramped stairwell. With the logic of nightmares, he pushed her after he had already fallen, and they lay together in a shattered heap, the chubby guy reassembling them incorrectly. Sauber made the call the next evening, waiting for Nina to pick up. He finally realized that it wasn't her who'd left those silent, searching messages. The chubby guy knew where he lived. He was sick with jelly-hard blood when she answered. He wanted no part of a grudge war. He wanted out. "It's done," he said. "I thought you should see it first." The upstairs neighbor always banged when Sauber used his power tools, and sometimes the people next door beat on the wall so hard he'd imagine they'd break through. He was pretty sure everyone was home from work when Nina arrived. It was after 7, so he began shouting as soon as he'd locked the door behind her. "You whore! You little whore! Who else is part of your harem?" Nina walked directly to a sculpture, which stood now in the middle of his living room. She turned and stared, but someone next door was quick to thump on the wall, and suddenly she was yelling too, her small hands shrunk into smaller fists. "I saved you! You don't! Who else knows about? You don't have a chance without me!" She advanced on him, aggressive as always, chin up, legs scissoring beneath her skirt. She probably figured that if she twisted her hips for another 10 seconds, he'd mount her right there against the kitchen counter while the neighbors listened. But Sauber had carefully placed his electric saw on the shelving alongside the door. Nina froze when he grabbed it. Then her arms lifted out from her sides like a woman on a tightrope. She made a noise like a word. "Nah." She screamed over the high whine of the saw, lurching back as he jumped after her with the churning blade held up between them. Just to destroy her composure was intensely gratifying. He laughed and she screamed again, and he thought he heard his neighbors panicking, somewhere beyond Nina's voice and the snarl of the saw as he pressed it down through the upholstery and wood frame of his couch. It couldn't last, of course, this chance to master her. He hurried when he wanted to dally, beyond excitement, near hysteria, adding his shrieks to hers. Too soon were the sirens outside, and the first shout at his doors was a woman's. "Police, open up!" He held them off until the media arrived. 16 more minutes, cramming his hand over his gasping laughter now. The cops couldn't seem to negotiate without hollering, since there was a door between them and a terrific circus outside as residents evacuated and news vans jammed in the street. Sauber was too familiar with confusion and fear to have difficulty pretending. "What are you doing?" he yelled back. "What are you doing?" "Sir, sir, just open up." He had allowed Nina to circle around him as the sirens approached, and she'd clawed at the door hard enough to leave one fingernail on the carpet before escaping. And if he was lucky, that would be the last he ever saw of her. His landlord would be furious. Yet Sauber had been careful to damage only his own furniture, and eviction proceedings in renter-friendly Berkeley moved with all the speed of a drowned worm. A charge of disturbing the peace was probably the worst he'd face. Nina wouldn't press charges. Assault with the deadly weapon, whatever, because she had too much to hide. Even if they stood him in front of a judge for obstructing a peace officer or resisting arrest, he had no record. They couldn't jail him. He only hoped that Nina never understood his true intent, because he didn't think he could outsmart her twice. Soon enough, she might suspect, unfortunately, if everything worked out right. If it was a slow night, local news footage of his sculpture might get 30 seconds or more in a million homes across the Bay Area, and it was exactly that kind of notoriety that started bidding wars. Sauber wasn't crazy.
I think it was an old CSI episode where someone asked why people died in threes. The answer, which of course Grissom gave, is that they don't, we just stop counting at three. Imposing a pattern on the world is something we all do, in fact it's something a lot of us are paid to do. After all, surely an analyst's job fundamentally is to take a look at the available information and guess which direction a situation will develop in. I'm reminded of the moment in the very first episode of The West Wing, when Leo asks one economist where the economy will be in a year's time, and he says, up 100 points. He asks the guy next to him where the economy will be in a year's time, and he says, down 100 points. And Leo looks at them and points out that one of them is going to look pretty stupid 12 months down the line. Of course, the situation is made even more complicated by the fact that meaning, fundamentally, has as much to do with the person involved in the situation as the situation they are trying to take meaning from. There have been moments in my life where I've gained sudden and immense comfort from something that I remain absolutely convinced was directed entirely at me. It clearly wasn't, unless I am Neo, in which case we're all in much, much more trouble than we previously thought. But to me, at that moment, it was, and is, And this is the thing, all that mattered. Meaning, pattern, is something ephemeral, something which is so often intensely personal and even more often intensely transitory. Enjoy it whilst it's there. Take comfort from it if you can, but never, ever try and bottle it. Because the only way that ends well is if you're Hamlet, and frankly, if Hamlet's a happy ending, you really need to revise your definitions. Wine and roses, beer and peanuts, me and calls for donations, matches, all made in heaven, or at least in audacity. The fact remains, we rely on you to pay our authors, so if you liked this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise you every red, blue, green, white, even the puce scents are appreciated. Pseudopod's theme music, by the way, is Bloodletting in the Naked Kiss by Anders Manga. Go to andersmanga.com to find out more. Pseudopod's favourite colour is red, and Pseudopod does enjoy long walks on the beach, although as yet there is no website for either of those two facts. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. And Pseudopod is kinda funny looking.